The Guardian.
This edition of Chips with Everything is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace offers a unique domain experience that's fully transparent and simple to set up. And there's also award-winning 24/7 customer support. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code CHIPS to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain.
This episode of Chips with Everything is also brought to you by Get Into Teaching. Teaching is a career that allows you to make a real difference to young people's lives, and it's a great way to make your degree, skills and knowledge really count. By sharing your passion for physics, chemistry and biology with the next generation, you could get £25,000 tax-free to train, subject to availability, selected subjects only. To find out more, search Get Into Teaching and register for tailored advice to start your teaching career, or head to getintoteaching.education.gov.uk.
Hey everybody, welcome to Chips with Everything, our digital culture and technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm your host, Lee Alexander, and today I hope you will indulge me in opening this week's episode with a little bit of a personal story. So a few years ago, some of my friends and my coworkers and I were targeted by an internet harassment mob to do with video games. You can probably read all about it online, so I'm not going to retread it all. But back then, we saw some signs. One thing was this targeting that we were experiencing was not just, angry young men saying mean words to us on the internet. It was a group campaign that was rooted in shared imagery, shared language, shared tactics. For example, mobbing individuals or people's employers with the same kind of text or pictures over and over. It also used manipulation and misinformation to rationalize its behavior. And worst of all, from my personal standpoint, it styled itself as a, quote, populist uprising. I guess for too long, feminists like me and progressives in general had been strangling the multi-billion dollar video game industry, and these disenfranchised video game fans would take no more. It sounds kind of ridiculous now that some time has passed, but it also sounds kind of familiar lately. In the recent election cycle, both here in the UK and back in my home of America, social media and populism have continued coupling in new and powerful ways. Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and the culture of image boards online are giving rise to anti-establishment iconography, memes as propaganda, and snippets of galvanizing text or imagery that proliferate in the service of political messages. Digital culture has become the primary frontier for both dialogue and, dare we hope, resistance. What makes social media so conducive to populist discourse? What commonalities do we see with the propaganda of yore? To find out how old power structures are being shaken by new platforms, I spoke to Dr. Paolo Gibaudo, a professor of digital culture at King's College London.
So what we're interested in is really how our social life is being reshaped by digital technology. It ranges from, say, dating sites, the new ways in which people look for love, friendship, to more public things ranging from economic activity, new companies like Uber and Airbnb, and the new gig economy they are developing, and the effects this economy has on the life of common people, as well as new social movements, as well as political parties that are emerging that are integrating various digital technologies in their functioning, from social media as Facebook and Twitter to new decision-making platforms. Really, as we know, all aspects of our society are reshaped by digital technology. And what we're interested in is how this change is taking place, and also to critically assess this change, because obviously not all this change is positive change. There are many problematic aspects to it. There are many pathological and traumatic aspects to it. And therefore, it is important to see both aspects, both sides of this change that we are currently undergoing.
Now, I'm old enough to remember a time when the internet felt new, like a sort of uncharted frontier where you could stash your private life or become a fictional character in a virtual world or live totally anonymously. Now, all of a sudden, it seems like these days the internet is real life. You know, total anonymity is difficult, if not impossible, even antisocial. Young people today grow up having their images online since they were baby photos on their parents' Facebook pages. Things we once would have considered private are now public and often worryingly permanent. And this has had some real ramifications lately.
People are far more conscious that whatever they say will be seen by a generic public and therefore judged in public terms. And that obviously has very important implications for political opinion. the statement you make on Facebook nowadays becomes really a public statement that will stay with you somehow for all your life. I mean, we also saw many political candidates, they were haunted by tweets they wrote years before, maybe joking or in such attitude, and then they come back to haunt them because they changed their opinion, or because that was possibly more of a private opinion or more of an informal opinion,
or
and down
predates
clashes.
The time that they were a public figure at all. They were not prepared to be accountable for those words in that manner.
So now it's become a sort of typical exercise of many new politicians to go back to their Twitter timeline and delete all stuff that is controversial, because there is this memory of you there online. Before it was very hard to keep a track of people's opinions when they were verbal opinions. Well, now those opinions are there, they are recorded. They're recorded potentially forever, and therefore they can always come back to haunt us at some point.
So let's get into some of the political tactics we're seeing take shape in the online space right now. Obviously, we have a Dawkins definition of what's a meme, but how do you define memes these days, and how has that concept sort of evolved in light of the political climate?
I mean, we could define memes as simplified messages that are known to spread virally online. I mean, this is really a minimalistic definition of what is ultimately a minimalistic type of web content. The objects we identify most frequently with memes are macro images that are utilizing pictures that are then accompanied by headlines in impact font and caption. But then also we can describe simplified tweets or Facebook posts as embodying memes themselves, when they are using highly simplified verbal expressions, phrases that come back and again, that amount to some sort of a catchword or catchphrase that you see repeated again and again in conversations. For example, I mean, an example of such memetic content that is not visual memetic content, it can be seen in the structure of Donald Trump's tweets, where you find this repetitive format, usually is three different sentences. One, and the first is a kind of topic sentence. The second is an argument that develops the first sentence. And finally, you often have this one word sentence at the very end, expressions that are sad, very sad, so bad, bad, be honest, I will fix it. Mm. Yeah? Which is a sort of payoff line, as you would call it in advertising, which fundamentally doesn't really tell you anything in terms of content-wise. It's more of a judgment. But there is something that chimes very well with the characteristics of social media, which, again, is not just about factual information. It's not just about describing or informing people, but it's also about judging things, evaluating things, and creating an emotional response to things. So this last sentence in Trump's tweets is precisely geared at that, at providing people with a sense of what to think about things and how to react to things, how to locate it in a very kind of manichaeist axis, bad or good, which ultimately works very well when it comes to addressing an audience that may not have a degree, that has uneven levels of education, which is, in a way, exactly the diversified audience that we are finding increasingly online, as less educated people and lower income people are joining us online.
When people use the word meme, they're usually referring to an iconographic or a funny image, perhaps with some white impact font text on it. But we're actually talking about something much bigger. Texts, templates, flexible frameworks that tend to kind of evolve past their original intention. The shape and function of the idea depends a great deal on the platform and the context in which it appears.
So social media are two things. On the one hand, social media are platforms that have certain technical properties. For example, like Twitter has 140 characters. You cannot go beyond that. So what that means is that they favor certain types of content. Yep. There is one level of social media. Then there is a second level of social media. There is the symbolic level. That is, social media are accompanied by certain culture. There are certain things that work on social media and certain things that don't work as well. For example, the content that works on social media is content that is curious, funny, irreverent. We all know about all the kind of funny cats, fads, sheep, and all sorts of funny animals. And so it's stuff that is half in jest, half serious, and that tends to have a so strong kind of anti-authoritarian element to that, which is connected to the strong individualism of social media. I mean, social media are both a reflection and a reversal of contemporary ideology, of neoliberalism. They are the most extreme embodiment of neoliberalism, in that neoliberalism is all about individualism, is all about faith in the power of the individual before collective agency. Accounts are individual accounts. All accounts on Twitter are individual accounts. Even if you're registering an account for an organization, you're registering that as an individual. And this individualism means that what works very well in terms of social media content is all the content that is about criticizing collective agencies, institutions, the state, or corporations, or large-scale organizations that are seen in a way as enemies of individual interest. And that is, in a way, neoliberalism on steroids. That is what social media is. The interesting thing, though, is that the ideology of social media moves from this neoliberalism on steroids to its reversal in populism. I mean, I think that populism can be described as an ideology that demands the restoration of popular sovereignty in a contest in which people feel the popular sovereignty is not there anymore. The popular sovereignty has been upset because of what? Because of globalization, because of the fact that decisions are more and more at a supranational level, either in the economic sector or in supranational political institutions, and therefore the people that were supposed to be responsible for deciding upon its own destiny doesn't have the same control over its own destiny as it had before.
Dr. Gerbaudo believes that social media is perhaps, in his words, neoliberalism on steroids, by which, you know, I think he means the commercialization or the attention economy around ideas that we might at least intend to be democratic or social. But he also says these infrastructures have created something he refers to as elective affinity.
The reason for the elective affinity, what we could describe as the elective affinity between social media and populism, is down to the meanings that have been assigned to social media. Social media as the voice of the underdog. Social media as an alternative to mainstream media. Social media as the space of the amateur, the space where people with no organizational affiliation, with no professional qualification, can express their voice and can be heard and can find other people whose opinions they share. So that is the point where all these individuals, all these people with no prior organizational affiliation, and people, furthermore, that often share a discontent at the establishment, can find each other and can become a crowd of disaffected individuals, which is the perfect starting point for populist movements. So populist movements arise when there is a mass of atomized individuals that don't recognize themselves in existing organizations and don't recognize themselves in existing institutions, including media institutions, and look for demands and leaders that can unify them despite all their differences and despite all their atomization to fight for their common cause. Yeah? Social media becomes such a cauldron where all these unaffiliated, unrepresented, and disaffected individuals can find each other and can push all in the same direction.
So let's take a break for a bit, and when we come back, what role do memes play in our political self-concept? And how did social media help a billionaire like Donald Trump somehow style himself as a populist hero?
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Try it for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code CHIPS to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Lee Alexander, and we've been speaking to King's College London's Dr. Paolo Gerbaudo about memes as the populist propaganda of our times. Last year, we got the chance to interview Bernie Sanders' social media strategy director, Kenneth Pennington. You can see a link to that episode in our show notes. We talked to Kenneth about how, thanks to creative internet fans and something called a dank meme stash, his candidate became a sort of virtual folk hero.
I mean, first is the entertainment value of these type of memes. And so Pepe the Frog is a comic character. It's not a serious character. It's very similar to many other types of content that we find online. That is, funny cats or funny animals or satirical pictures, parodic pictures. Right? It fits within this genre of content. Secondly is its repetition. So we find Pepe the Frog everywhere in thousands of different variations. It comes to act as a sort of leitmotif that connects very different contents with the same imaginary, right? And the imaginary being ultimately the idea of Trump as somebody who can represent the unrepresented. I mean, Pepe the Frog, in a way, that is what it represents. It represents the citizens whose voice are not validated, or the citizens who feel their voice is not heard. The citizens who feel that because of politically correctedness, which, as we know, was a major theme in Trump's campaign, are see their views and their demands kept out of political debate.
We also met another professor who's been studying Podemos, Spain's new political party.
So my name is Emmy Eklund, and I'm a teaching fellow in Spanish politics here at King's College London.
Podemos, I'm pretty sure, means we can in Spanish, and its rise has transformed the landscape, particularly on the populist front. Dr. Eklund says that party leader Pablo Iglesias has been cast as a symbol in a climate that needs imagery and symbology more than ever.
And anything can become populist in the sense. You can have any sort of slogan or motto, symbols, pictures, people. All of these can become populist symbols. Now, social media are good at creating that sort of investment and popularity in one item because you can share it, they spread quickly, and therefore you can have, like, the leader of Podemos, Pablo Iglesias, become the symbol and the one thing that people can relate to, which then is significant for the whole movement. And he is the sort of what we would call the signifier or the one thing that people associate with when they want to vote or participate in politics.
It's now even harder for politicians to control their image or their narrative, and this is probably a good thing.
It's impossible to some extent to control social media completely. Now, what there is, though, is direction. And Podemos had played this very, very carefully and managed to direct the debate in a very strategic and conscious way. So yes, they do control the narrative to some extent, but it's never completely controllable in the sense.
I wrote a Guardian article last year in which I asserted that memes, which distill and repeat a candidate's most awkward moments or their creepiest handshakes over and over again, played some small role in hounding Ted Cruz out of the Republican nomination race. He saw himself as something of a party moderate and a family man, but on the internet, he became the Zodiac Killer, Count Dracula, and he was even photoshopped several times to resemble trash can nacho chef Guy Fieri. Love Guy Fieri. But how big of a role does this imagery really play in political outcomes?
I think memes are central to the process of group identification, which, again, is a very important component of politics, and a component of politics that people have for long overlooked. It is for a long time the main explanation about political behavior and about political preference was all about rationality. You know, human beings are sort of computers. They receive information from news media. Then they process this information. They look at their wallet. They calculate how much they would pay in taxes and how much they would get in services according to whether they are rich or poor, whether they have kids or not. And then they will decide that in extremely rational terms, right? This is the rational actor theory explanation of political behavior. In fact, we know that that is not the case. Politics and political behavior is about irrational, in quotes, things, emotional things, is about group identification. And this is where social media enters the picture. It enters the picture at the time of extreme cynicism about politics, of very weak political identification, which go hand in hand with people's desire to identify themselves with people, with concrete people they can believe in.
So now we're all able to find our people more quickly and accurately than ever, and it's easier than ever to splinter off into ever louder and more passionate tribes. That makes Twitter virtually no fun to use these days, but should we be concerned about any potential larger consequences of all this tribalism?
I mean, I sympathize with this tribalism in that I never believed in the liberal idea of politics as a rational pursuit. Because I think that politics was not like that also before, when there was a very strong class divide in countries like Britain. I mean, Labour, the identification, for example, of Labour voters with the Labour Party was really about a profound hate for the Tories, personal visceral hate. We still find re-emerging sometimes in demonstrations when we hear slogans such as "Stories Come." Politics is the way in which society can manage conflict without getting people killed, without bloodshed. Right? And it is really the case. It's an ongoing civil war that is pacified because people all abide by a principle that who gets elected wins. So it's not who kills more people who wins, but who gets elected wins. And therefore, you can only expect that from politics, especially in historical conjunctures, the present one, where you can only expect people to be angry, and people are angry for very right reasons. It's not irrational. Not even Trump's supporters' behavior is irrational. I mean, unless we understand the reasons for the political choice, we go nowhere in devising an alternative strategy. So the paradoxical thing there is the way in which Trump, a billionaire, managed to present himself as the champion of the 99% against the 1%. Yeah. And the internet and social media played a very important role there because he managed to present himself precisely because of the enmity of mainstream news media towards him and the comparative support he enjoyed on social media, or at least on certain social media, he could present himself as the underdog, which obviously he's not. I mean, he's a billionaire, he's an inherited billionaire. Still, he managed to mobilize this allure that social media have as a space that is more authentic, more real, more down-to-earth, less controlled than mainstream news media are.
So can we say that memes are like modern political cartoons in that they help us understand the complexity of our political climate and images, or does that sort of many-to-one ratio completely change the conversation?
I mean, something that really strikes me is the similarity between memes and political propaganda posters. There are many similarities with them because you have this very simple picture that really needs to be understood even by the dumbest person who is passing by the poster, and a very simplified title and a payoff line there as well. And this is really the format we also find in memes, right? Where you have these very simplified structures, this message that needs to be understood by everybody. And there is a sort of dumbing down, in a way, of memes that is about allowing them to be understood also by people who don't have a degree, who don't have a kind of critical theory or comparative literature degree, right? Which happens to be the 99% of the population.
Dr. Anastasia Denisova, a journalism lecturer at University of Westminster School of Media, sees things a little differently. What if this supposedly democratic language isn't populist at all, but is rapidly becoming co-opted by elites and oppressors?
I started looking at the memes as the means of alternative political communication in Russia, because, to be honest with you, 5 years ago, they weren't really mainstream, and they were really popular as a digital culture. So people were really using them to be against the government, to say something different, to be resistant to the mainstream discourse. But over the recent years, we've seen that memes have been really been appropriated by the dominant regimes, by the elites, by the governments, even by the campaigners a lot. And I think in this particular media environment of 2017, we can really talk about memes as a mainstream communication tools. And I even have a feeling that these days, those memes that have been generated by the elites and the governments are much more influential and powerful. So there is a certain hierarchy. So when I just started my research in memes 5 years ago, memes were very democratic in a sense that everybody could create a meme, put it through, it would become, you know, shared and viral. These days, those memes that come from the opinion leaders, from, I don't know, like presidential candidates and politicians, they're more likely, you know, to hit the spot, to ride the wave than those coming from those individual accounts.
As a woman in tech who's often targeted by, you know, relatively privileged hate groups online, I do tend to agree with her concerns. It's also worrying that we think the content we encounter online comes from a neutral source, but it's in fact been tailored for us individually by private companies based on who they think we are. Most people are not even aware that their internet experience is unique to them, tailored to subtly reinforce their beliefs about the world.
No, I mean, that's why the richest companies, you know, in the world, they come from the Silicon Valley, from the digital world. And well, not by chance, to be honest, right? Because, I mean, there is no neutral filter, there is no neutral kind of content regulation. Somebody benefits, yeah, you know, from that. Even when you seek, you know, the best intentions to produce content, to disseminate content, you always stick to your own beliefs, conscious or subconscious. And that will, you know, have a lot of implications on the kind of information you put out there.
Because of the platforms on which our conversations now primarily happen, the very nature and tenor of political discourse and tactics totally changed. Well, if the meme horse is out of the meme barn, I might as well keep collecting these adorable communist opossum pictures. That's all for Chips with Everything this week. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like the show, please tell a friend, or better yet, give us a rating on iTunes. It helps more people find out about our work. You can also subscribe to this and other great Guardian programming on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. If you've got a digital culture topic for us, please get in touch at guardianships@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter at Lee Alexander, though I can't promise I'm not a raging tribalist. Join us next week. Thanks, everyone.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.